This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer David Rakoff. He's a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life and to the magazines GQ and Outside. He's also an actor and has worked in theater with David and Amy Sedaris. If you pay very close attention, you'll see him briefly in the new movie Capote. Rakoff's latest collection of humorous essays is about the culture of excess. It's called Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems. The opening essay is about becoming an American citizen a couple of years ago. He's from Canada, but has lived in New York for many years. Here's a short reading in which he describes struggling over the 10-page-long naturalization application. He figures it should require about a day or two of work, but it took him 4 months and 1 week.
My first hang-up occurs at Part 10, Section G, Question 33. Are you a male who lived in the United States at any time between your 18th and 26th birthdays in any status except as a lawful non-immigrant? I make my living with words, and yet I cannot for the life of me begin to parse this question with its embedded double negatives and hypotheticals. How are any non-native speakers managing to become citizens, I wonder? Part of my clouded judgment is due to fear. I don't want to piss them off, and I am worried that a wrong answer will immediately feed my name into some database for a wiretap, a tax audit, or an automatic years-long misplacement of my application, some casual, gratuitous harassment that a thuggish administration might decide to visit upon someone they identified as a troublemaker. I spend an entire afternoon trying to map the grammar and come away with nothing but a headache and no idea. This is in early March. I put the form away in my drawer and forget about it. My dreams of inalienable rights failed by just one question. I put all thoughts of citizenship out of my head until one evening in July, 4 months later, when, as I'm dropping off to sleep, the clauses fall into place and the lock turns and I realize the answer is a simple no. With inordinate self-satisfaction, I soldier on. Have I ever been an habitual drunkard? I have not. A prostitute, a procurer, or a bigamist? Nuh-uh. Did I in any way aid, abet, support, work for, or claim membership in the Nazi government of Germany between March 23, 1933 and May 8, 1945? Nein. Do I understand and support the Constitution? You betcha. If the law required it, would I be willing to bear arms on behalf of the United States? Again, I stop. The same headache as before marches its little foot soldiers across my cranium. I put the application back into the drawer and return to my bed, not picking it up again until 7 days later, when I surprise myself by checking yes.
Why was that a surprise that you would check yes to that question about bearing arms?
Well, because for a variety of reasons. I was raised as a sort of a pacifist, socialist, you know, Hebrew school child. So bearing arms was... is a fairly extreme thing and very alien to my upbringing. We're also not even sort of violent or aggressive people. You know, we can't throw balls, we can't catch balls, we don't... You know, there's none of that sort of... I wasn't a hockey child, so I don't have that particular bellicose outlet. So that was a surprise. And then, of course, if you weren't born here and you become a citizen, if you're an adoptive American, that whole kind of swaggering... militaristic George Patton, that whole framing of masculinity is not something that is in your DNA. Regardless of your placement on the Kinsey scale, it's really rare. Do you know what I mean? It's just rare to sort of come here, not having been born here, and be John Wayne. You know, at most you might be Burt Lancaster, but in The Swimmer or in The Big Tent or whatever it's called, you know, but otherwise so that was a real surprise. And also, given the history of the United States and long before, you know, what's going on in Iraq and everything, I can't think of a whole lot of wars that I would willingly take up arms for. I say at the beginning of the chapter, well, I say later on in the chapter that there are a whole lot of conflicts that I could imagine taking up arms for. You know, the situation in Darfur strikes me as being fairly cut and dry, and perhaps I'm being naive, but it seems like one should just go in there with armaments and, you know, stop the Janjaweed. Or, you know, the minute the words ethnic cleansing were coming out of former Yugoslavia, it struck me as being an opportune time to, you know, to twig to that historical precedent of what happens in Europe when they say ethnic cleansing and really do something about it.
Why did you want to become an American citizen? You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada, and I have lived in New York essentially since I was 17 years old. So that's 6.5 years. No, it's been, you know, a long time. I'm now pushing 41. And so all my formative years have really been spent here in New York. And it got to the point where I had this civic life, which was pretty rich. You know, I paid taxes, I went on demonstrations, I was, if not directly politically involved, politically informed and engaged and everything. And there was this one central lack in my life, and that was the right to vote. And things were becoming very dire, in my opinion. I really needed to vote for myself. I have no illusions of the fact that, like, yet another gay New York Jewish liberal who works in the media is really going to tip the balance in any way. But for myself, it was just I couldn't go on in this sort of shadow status. I also have to admit, I stopped feeling safe here, despite the fact that I am, you know, white, well-spoken, well-educated, I make a living, I pay taxes, I own property. It had stopped. I no longer had this kind of implicit faith in the ultimate fairness of the administration that is sitting. And I stopped feeling safe here. And I didn't want to be put out of my home.
So does it feel much different to be a citizen now?
Does it feel different? A little bit. It feels, I confess to having some ambivalence about having done it still. And this apparently, from my very anecdotal and informal poll, turns out to be a very common feeling among adoptive Americans. At least people who are adoptively American late, because, you know, the reputation of the country has changed over the last few years. And so I do feel ambivalent about it. I feel that it has, on the other hand, completely legitimized and ratified the most important reason I did it and the most important relationship of my life, which is my relationship to New York City, which I love with a kind of embarrassing depth. This is the thing that actually makes me the typical American immigrant, is the way that I feel about New York City. It's been a state of affairs for immigrants to this city for a century or more. You know, I just can't get over how much I love New York City.
One of your essays is about your experiences going to two cosmetic surgeons in Beverly Hills. And you have them each give you an assessment of the work that they think should be done on your face. New definition of masochism to do that. Why did you do this?
Well, I did it, initially I did it for, you know, for an assignment. But of course, I don't take any assignment that I don't immediately leap at. I mean, the thought of, when it was suggested to me, I was at dinner with my editor, and I virtually leapt across the table at the prospect of doing something like this. It seemed fascinating. There is a masochistic quality to it that I reacted to. I sort of would enjoy that. You know, I kind of, I don't know, I want to bother it like a loose tooth or something. It just seemed fascinating. And also, it seemed that we are on the cusp of something. We are right down the rabbit hole in terms of this aesthetic tyranny, which seems to be getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, to the point where I often think, you know, about 20 years ago, or maybe it's longer, I can't do the math right now, Jill Clayburgh was a bankable movie star. She was, you know, the star of movies. A lovely-looking woman. Jill Clayburgh couldn't get work now as Quasimodo. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just what's happened is, you know, the ugly best friend is now Julia Roberts because she's over 37. It's unbelievable to me. Imogene Coca, huge star. Giulietta Masina, a huge star. You couldn't get work as Giulietta Masina today. You know, waiting tables, you couldn't get work as Giulietta Masina. So it seemed like we're in this place where, you know, I'm an okay-looking guy, but as I say in the book, you know, my face has never been my calling card. At the same time, I'm very lucky. It's not a punchline. You know, it's not the worst face in the world. People don't look at me one way or another. Whatever ways I've had to manifest have been through other, you know, tricks. Like a fancy vocabulary or something. But, you know, so I went to these guys because I thought, mistakenly, as it turns out, I thought these guys were the Pharisees. You know, I essentially thought that these were the guys pushing the agenda. And on some level, they must be the guys pushing the agenda because they normalize, you know, procedures that, let's be honest, cut you open, shove a tube in, suck the fat out, break your bones, move stuff around. I mean, it's really brutal, brutal stuff. I don't have cable, but apparently, is there a channel that's either just the surgery channel or it's the plastic surgery channel? I can't remember which. But, you know, a lot of people have become inured to these processes. They know what it is. But, you know, I watched videotapes of liposuction. It's unbelievably violent. So I went to these guys thinking, you are the people who are perpetrating on this. This onto an unwitting public. You're the guys who have made it a cardinal sin for Jill Clayburgh to exist. Of course, that wasn't the case. These guys are extremely conservative in their approach. And there's a reason, actually, that these two guys are the two top surgeons in Beverly Hills for what it is they do, you know.
So what do they say to you looking at... I mean, you're a writer and an actor. So what do they say to you looking at your face?
Well, they were very reluctant to do anything. Like, I kept on telling them about my thick skin and that I didn't mind and that it was for a story and that they should just have at me. And they still wouldn't really do it. One of them mentioned as how they might straighten out the tip of my nose. It apparently it droops down to an unhealthy degree. It's, you know, it's your typical usurer's nose from an anti-Semitic cartoon kind of thing, with a little less character, actually. And they thought that they might get rid of a furrow between my eyebrows, you know, and clean up some of the bags under my eyes. But really, other than that, it was just sort of a freshening up. It was like tuning up a car, I guess, although I don't drive a car. So what I'm assuming is like a car tune-up. But they never said, you know, we'll cut out this, we'll give you, you know, we'll give you a huge square jaw, we'll cap your teeth, we'll give you a new nose, we'll, you know, change your eye color, you know, all manner of things, we'll give you a hair transplant. I was really hoping for that kind of overhaul, at least theoretically. And it just didn't happen. They wouldn't do it.
Why is it in your writing that, on the whole, you've chosen subjects that are not the most life and death subjects of our age?
You mean, why am I not going to war zones?
Yeah. Do you ever feel like you should be doing this as a writer? You should be. You know, instead of going to the cosmetic surgeon or, you know, writing about seeing the show Puppetry of the Penis, or, you know,
yeah.
Writing about your affection for Martha Stewart, yeah, that you should be going into war zones or, you know, covering like the major stories of our day, or, you know, like personal tragedies, or, you know, just
like, you mean my personal tragedies or other people's personal tragedies?
Either.
Well, a few things occur to me. You know, the fact that I am shallow as a puddle frequently worries me enormously. And the hope is... Well, two things. The hope is that somehow the pieces touch on something deeper than their surface subjects. You know, the Puppetry of the Penis piece is meant to be this sort of deeper meditation on the way a city recovers, mostly New York City after 9/11. And, you know, it's done in the most oblique, subtle, perhaps not detectable to the reader kind of way. But also because of this sort of humorous sensibility that I have, I mean, I can be deadly serious, and I'm deadly serious about many things, but those are generally private things. I wouldn't want to write about someone else's personal tragedy. I'm uncomfortable with that kind of reporting. I'm uncomfortable with prying in that way. I'm not dogged about other people's information in that way. I can't do it. I've tried, but my feeling is, other than elected politicians, no one owes you their story. And I think you need, to be a really good reporter, you need to feel that people owe you their story. I've never been that guy. Mm-hmm. And that might be having grown up in Canada. I can't do it. I can't, you know, I could no sooner go up to somebody who had just lost everything and say, how do you feel? I mean, I can guess how they feel. They feel lousy. You know, I can't ask that sort of second question when they essentially tell me to drop dead. I can't do it. I'm not brave in that way.
The last time we spoke in 2001, you said something that I thought was very interesting and also very funny, which was that you'd carry around a Xanax with you and probably like never use it, but just having it there calmed you down because you knew that you had an option. If things got really bad, you had the chance.
I could just check out.
Right. Yeah. You could take this anti-anxiety pill or give it to somebody else who needed it even more.
Exactly.
And so... do you still carry it around as almost a talisman?
Oh, absolutely! It's still there, in my little in the container that I keep my breath mints in. My breath mints, my breath mints I take with almost religious regularity. But the Xanax I don't take so much. But its presence is tremendously helpful. As I get older, certain little phobias get more pronounced. You know, my claustrophobia is worse than it used to be. Sometimes my agoraphobia kicks in. And you never want to be the person in the stalled subway car who is just losing it. You know, you don't want to be that embarrassing example of, oh my God, you guys, we're all going to die. You know, I've certainly felt like I've wanted to be that person. I don't want to be the person, because then eventually, the subway starts to move and you emerge into the light. And you're just there having soiled yourself and you have to get home. So it's just, as a sort of a counterphobic measure, I keep the Xanax on my person. But I have to say, I now ride in the front car of the subway.
Why?
Because I need to look out the front window. I just need to know that we're moving forward. I need to be near the driver to know that he doesn't, that he exists or she exists. It's just one of these little, counterphobic things. Because here's the thing. I don't not take the subway. That's the main thing. I won't, if I can walk, I'll walk. But that's just New York. I just like to walk. But, I can't let it stop my life. I was a very phobic little kid. Faggy phobic. Oh, it was a lot of fun. And it was my father who said, you can let these things rule your life. And you mustn't. And so I sort of understood early on, feel the fear and do it anyway. And I was even talking to one of my nephews recently, because we were in Buffalo over Labor Day weekend. We were going up to the old City Hall, which is a beautiful building. It's got this beautiful observatory at the top. And I said, I'll go to the elevator with you and I'll come up with you, but I'm not going on the balcony. He said, why? And I said, don't you know that I'm scared of everything? I'm scared of everything, but I do it anyway. But I won't go on an outdoor balcony 25 feet up in the air. But yes, I do keep the Xanax. And I also, I have to say, I give away a lot of Xanax.
Well, you've given me a new aphorism to live by now. Feel the fear and do it anyway. I like that.
Oh, I think it might be a self-help book that's called that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, David Rakoff, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
David Rakoff's new collection of humorous essays is called Don't Get Too Comfortable.